Welcome. This is Christopher Holmes, and this is the two-hour Zero Point radio show through BBS Radio. It's November 13th, 2010. I'd like to open with just two brief quotations by mystic G.I. Gurdjieff. And the first one is from his masterpiece story called Beelzebub's Tales. And Gurdjieff says, "In everything under the care of Mother Nature, the possibility is foreseen for beings to acquire the kernel of their essence, that is to say, their own I." And a second quote by Gurdjieff: "So first thing must learn is no self. If not do this, then will be like acorn that not become tree." Today we're going to be exploring, actually for the next 3 or 4 weeks, we're going to be exploring the fourth way teachings of G.I. Gurdjieff and his major student, P.D. Uspensky. Gurdjieff lived from about 1872 to 1949, and Uspensky was roughly the same period. Their teaching is known throughout the world among smaller groups of people who study the Gurdjieff work, or practice his sacred dances, or have been influenced by Gurdjieff. And it's an amazing mystical teaching, and I was first introduced to it 40 years ago, and without doubt, it has changed my life and my inner awareness and experience of being through having studied this teaching over the last 40 years of my life. And I feel that through this effort, in some ways, I've attained something in my own self-development or awareness of being through this process. So I hope these next shows over the next few weeks will give listeners some practical guide to basic self-study and the study of psychology. Like Gurdjieff explains that humankind are in a state of semi-consciousness, half asleep. They do not attain the consciousness proper to three-brained beings. And then they do not attain the kernel of their essence, which that is to say, their own I. Gurdjieff, he has a different view from other religious philosophies and mystical philosophies. Like, science tends to suggest the human being has no soul, and religious teachings suggest that everybody has a soul and is guaranteed some kind of eternal life. And the Gurdjieff, in a sense, is in between. He says that a human being does not simply just possess a soul as such, but rather he has to attain it. We have to attain our own I, and we have to attain this development of consciousness within ourselves. He says, these are things that won't just happen. Instead, they require conscious effort on someone's part in terms of striving towards one's own self-perfection, is one of the terms Gurdjieff uses. Well, over the next 3 to 4 weeks, we're going to firstly be exploring the basic Gurdjieff, or the Uspenskian version of the Gurdjieff teaching more, which is a more practical and systematic presentation of Gurdjieff's major ideas. And then following that, we're going to do a series of shows on Beelzebub's Tales, which is a most bizarre story by Gurdjieff. The book is about 1,200 to 1,300 pages long, and it's this kind of cosmic tale about Beelzebub traveling on a spaceship and talking about his visits to the planet Earth and how strange the three-brained beings on planet Earth are, and how they have these horrendous processes, which he calls the processes of reciprocal destruction, or what we would call war. And Beelzebub's Tales is like this view from an outside source of the history of humanity and mankind's brutality and the war and unconsciousness. So we're going to do a series of shows on Beelzebub's Tales, which is clearly one of the masterpieces of modern literature of the past century. And it's a book, it's quite shocking, actually. Beelzebub's Tales, there are no books other than the one I've just published called The Slugs, which attempt to explain the basic story and principles of Beelzebub's Tales. And it's a very, very difficult book, and we should have a interesting and funny because Gurdjieff is so humorous in how he presents the follies and foibles of humankind in this story of Beelzebub's Tales. So we're planning at this point in our show to do this series on G.I. Gurdjieff. Okay, so I'll welcome my guest, Jim Moffat from Toronto, Ontario. Jim, how are you?
I'm good. How are you, Chris?
Yeah, good. So it's interesting to get back to the Gurdjieff material.
Yeah.
Yeah, it kind of takes us back as thinking, oh, it's like 40 years since we began studying this.
Yeah.
Maybe just under 40.
Well, yes, it's 35, but, you know, I mean, yeah. At this point, counting, it's a long time. I guess one thing, a couple of things that you mentioned. One is that, you know, you talked about the Uspenskian version versus the version of Beelzebub Tales, but just to be, you know, to clarify a little, Uspensky's book, The In Search of Miraculous, is recounts his years, the first 6 or 7 years that he was associated with Gurdjieff from, I think, roughly 1915 to 1922 in Russia, and then later in Constantinople and in the Caucasus in what was Russia. And in that period, Gurdjieff presented various talks and gave various lectures, not formal lectures per se, but worked with a group of people in Moscow and St. Petersburg in Russia and gave various talks to them, and would present his ideas about his teaching, his psychological and cosmological aspects of his teaching. And as Uspensky explains in Search of the Miraculous, it's an interesting book because the way it's presented, it's not presented. It's very systematic in a sense, but it's not presented like here's the psychology, here's the cosmology, and it's just laid out. It's various topics. And it recounts Gurdjieff's talks about these topics, and it moves around and develops in its own peculiar sense the way it unfolds. But that's how Gurdjieff would teach the system to the people that were learning. Like Uspensky says at one point, he would give people the beginnings of ideas and see what they made of them, and then he would amplify on them according to what people, the type of feedback they gave him. So it was always kind of, even though he knew it, he wouldn't just sort of tell people everything all at once. He would ask them to work with the ideas and to come back and ask him questions and to further amplify and elaborate on different ideas. And during the period of the early 20s, Gurdjieff gave talks in London and in New York and questions and answer periods, and some of those are collected in a book called Views from the Real World. So you get this teaching, which Uspensky, to a certain degree, in his further works, like his book The Fourth Way and The Psychology of Man's Possible Evolution, Uspensky systematizes it to a certain extent and tries to tries to put things into a logical structure. And it's certainly there in all of Gurdjieff's work. I mean, but that for Gurdjieff was one part of his work. And then later, after Gurdjieff had established his institute outside of Paris in the 20s, he had a car accident in 1924. And after that, he undertook to do something which he said he wished with all his being not to do, which was to write about his ideas. And that ends up being his trilogy of books called All and Everything, and the masterpiece, as you made mention of, is Beelzebub's Tales to His Grandson. There's a second book, Meetings with Remarkable Men, which deals with Gurdjieff's childhood to a certain extent and his quest to find secret knowledge with others who shared his aim. And then a third book, which was incomplete, called Life is Only Real Then When I Am, which deals with aspects of Gurdjieff's own struggle to develop his being and to overcome aspects of his own character. And in the books, it's interesting, Gurdjieff's writing, as you say, there's Beelzebub's Tales with His Grandson, is there's nothing quite like it that I know of in modern literature. It's a very, very strange book. It's an allegory, and it's told as an epic tale. And it's written in this very difficult, peculiar cadence that he has, that and has all sorts of neologisms to describe different things. So everything takes on kind of the strangeness, because he'll give names, exotic names to familiar objects, like a Tescuano is a telescope, and everything is elaborated on in these peculiar terms, but all to a purpose and to effect. Yet so the teaching that's articulated in Beelzebub's Tales is really quite unrecognizable when you compare it to that which occurs in Uspensky's books, or which in Gurdjieff's lectures and in Uspensky's commentaries on them. There's a rationality and an elegance and a coherence to it, which is all quite striking, which is resonates, resonates with our own feelings about the nature of psychology, and develop certain things that we clearly didn't understand. But in Beelzebub, it's everything is disguised and everything is hidden, but it creates the writing creates these strange feelings, and you really have to work to try to understand this book. It's not an easy read by any stretch of the imagination. And yet, and a lot of people have seized on that and said, well, it's just because Gurdjieff was a terrible writer and he was being bombastic and being deliberately obtuse, and no, because if you read Meetings with Remarkable Men, it reads beautifully. It's a very entertaining, again, it's an allegory, I think, about the nature of searching for truth, but it's a very engaging and very straightforward exposition of certain ideas, and more of a tale and an entertaining story. So clearly he could have written a normal book, and he says over and over again that he eschews what he calls the bon ton literary language. Like, he doesn't want to be an artist and in any conventional definition of the word. And he's not sending any kind of a recognizable religious teaching, although there is a strong religious dimension to it. It's all phrased in a very different kind of a mythological parable about the history of humankind. This is in Beelzebub's Tales. So you have these two extremely different articulations of Gurdjieff's system, the fourth way of his teaching. And when they're taken together, I mean, each of them independently is fascinating. When they're taken together, you see the incredible depth of his teaching and of him as a teacher. And then there's a whole other physical dimension to everything he did, because he worked very directly with his pupils in terms of developing them physically, and actually said that all awakening and development of consciousness begins with self-sensing and awakening in the body. And Gurdjieff himself had studied widely in his travels in the near and far east. He had studied sacred dances and was a teacher. He referred sometimes facetiously to himself as being a teacher of dancing, but he was an expert in these in these ancient dances and sacred gymnastics, and taught his pupils as a means of developing attention and physical mastery, and gave various demonstrations in Paris and in North America, and in New York and Boston and Chicago and various other places in the States. And everybody, there were various opinions about Gurdjieff, but everybody who seems to have seen the movement seems to have been terribly impressed by them, because they're quite unlike anything else that anybody had ever seen, including professional dancers, as he had several people in his ranks who were professional dancers and said that, you know, that he was teaching something quite different from what professional dancers learn. So you see in the whole variety of Gurdjieff's teaching when you see it as an entire body, you see like what an incredibly complex and deep person he was, and how knowledgeable he was about so many different things, to be able to switch like he did in terms of the way he presented his teaching was that, you know, he always said that the teaching was more to learn it was more important than to know it, in the sense like to incorporate it was more important than to be able to recite it. So he kept changing the actual terms in which it was articulated, but his teaching has that depth. And as you say, 35 years later, it's still resonating with us and still, you know, leading us to make new connections to see new things in it. So it's quite an amazing. I don't know of any other teaching that to me is so suited for a Westerner, particularly one who is not going to retreat from the world, but wants to be in the world, but not of it, as the Sufis say. And I think that kind of captures the essence of the fourth way. It's a teaching for self-transformation and psycho-spiritual transformation, but it doesn't require one to retreat from the world, but rather just to practice it and to be in the world, but not to be of the world.
Yeah, so hopefully today we can start giving some basic explanations of the basic fourth way method of self-study and the basic ideas about consciousness and the centers and things along that line.
Yeah.
I remember one of the things that struck me in reading some of the fourth way by Uspensky, he said, people want to understand supernormal psychology. And that he explained the problem is that they don't understand normal psychology, and you can't really understand supernormal psychology until you kind of more fully appreciate what normal psychology involves. And I think the fourth way teaching is like the link from normal to supernormal psychology. That's how I see it. Like, I read other mystical or esoteric psychologies, and they're all in the mystical realm, and it's a beautiful and amazing materials, but in a way it's not grounded in the basic self, like understanding of self and the parts of one's being, and it's not grounded in that way. And I think Gurdjieff is this perfect link from, on the one hand, like modern thought and philosophy and psychology. Gurdjieff kind of connects to that, but then it connects into the study of the paranormal and the supernormal. And Gurdjieff has a whole complex science of the soul that he explains. Like he says how we can develop our higher being bodies, and that this is an alchemical process. And we'll go into this over the next shows. So he says we have to attain our souls, but that means to develop our higher being bodies. And we have to attain our real I. Like Gurdjieff would say, people don't really know what I is. Like, we always say I, but Gurdjieff explains that humankind, the masses of people, don't simply have one I. They have a multitude of little eyes and partial aspects of themselves, which are in control in different situations according to how they're stimulated and their conditioning history. So we become fragmented, and we do not know real I in ourselves. and we do not know what real consciousness is, and we do not know what real will is. Gurdjieff says, like, we only know little daily wills and wants, but we haven't attained real will. So this is, it's understanding such things as the concept of what it means to have an I, and what it means to be conscious, and what it means to be have will versus being an automaton. So Gurdjieff, his system of teaching, I think most links Western psychology and science into the mystical tradition, and provides keys also to understanding other the esoteric aspects of other teachings. Like, I think Gurdjieff's explanation of the fundamental cosmic laws of 3 and 7. If you understand that concept from Gurdjieff, then you can find it in Blavatsky's secret doctrine, Kabbalistic teachings, esoteric Christianity, and all other kinds of sources. But Gurdjieff's explanations of it are particularly clear in a way, and help you understand the significance of those ideas. So I really see the Gurdjieff material as this link between where people are at versus getting to understand the realm of supernormal psychology. I'm sure you agree, Jim, with that. I think that's why you and I were so ripe for the Gurdjieff work, because we were both studying modern psychology. We were interested in the nature of self and the nature of consciousness, and Gurdjieff's teaching was so clear relative to the disciplines we were studying. Like, it wasn't hokey pokey. There's nothing hokey pokey about it. It was much clearer and more articulate than what we were being fed in our academic studies.
Yeah, and I really like what you said before when you said that. That's always been one of my favorite quotes from Uspensky about we don't understand normal psychology. In order to understand supernormal psychology, we have to understand normal psychology first. And I remember when I first read that, because part of the attraction for you and I is we were both interested in paranormal and parapsychological phenomena. And, I mean, I had a certain interest in consciousness before the fourth way, but really didn't understand it. You know, I thought it was interesting. I was more interested in the nature of the self, I think. But when I read that Gurdjieff at the beginning, when I began to study the fourth way, it really turned the lights on for me as to the importance of consciousness. But it's like what really attracted me is what you just said, is that his analysis of normal psychology was so complex and so, but at the same time so coherent and so precise, that I had never really imagined that anything like that could exist. And it really stood out in contrast, I think, to all modern psychology. It seemed much more comprehensive and much more coherent to me, and yet within his framework you could understand how the different psychological ideas in personality theory, for example, all sort of fit within his framework, but his framework was much more comprehensive. But the main thing was his most basic idea that our normal waking consciousness is not a proper consciousness, but is rather a state of waking sleep in which we exist in a state of hypnotic associative thinking and feeling and acting and sensing. And this is really quite different from anything in Western psychology. And then the idea that the proper study of consciousness involves a study of oneself in terms of a system, and not just willy-nilly, but rather systematically. And again, there's nothing really in Western psychology. Like in the history of Western psychology, there was a movement, introspectionism, in the late 1800s, early 19th century, in which people tried to introspect on their consciousness and tried to observe tried to categorize and detail what they observed. But the problem with introspectionism was that there was no systematic approach to the study of oneself, and in a way, it's too bad, because introspectionism sort of disqualified and discredited the idea of self-study, and yet it's I would say introspectionism is naive self-study, whereas Gurdjieff's system is sophisticated and scientific self-study. So it's very it's to me it's demonstrably superior and way beyond anything in Western psychology in terms of studying oneself. But this whole idea that you had to study consciousness within oneself in order to understand it is so opposed to everything that we were learning as psychology students in Western psychology, because Western psychologists don't study themselves. They study others, other human beings, they study animals, but they never study themselves, and they never study consciousness within themselves, so they don't really have much of a grasp of the nature of self, the nature of the I experience. It's extraordinary, and the nature of consciousness. It's extraordinary when you look at the history of Western psychology, how little is understood about the nature of the I experience. I mean, when you get beyond the psychoanalysts who do go into the nature of ego, there's very little writing in Western psychology about the I experience. It's quite striking once you look at it from the perspective of the fourth way and from other esoteric teachings. And as you say, I think for me, like I don't know of any other esoteric or mystical teaching that is so grounded in presenting such a detailed analysis of normal psychology, and it creates that bridge, that link to the study of supernormal psychology. And as you say, once you grasp the fourth way system, so many things that are articulated in that system really shed light on other esoteric and mystical teachings, and I think allow you to comprehend what's being said in a much deeper and more profound sense. There's something really different about, I mean, Gurdjieff said that the fourth way was a very different system from other esoteric and mystical teachings, but there seems to be something really different from it, and in some ways I think it's superior to other teachings in its comprehensiveness, and yet at the same time it's an incomplete teaching, so it you have to study other teachings to really develop ideas within the fourth way.
I had an interesting experience about a couple of weeks ago, Jim. I was on friend Don Nikoloff's BBS radio show, which I listen to through the week as much as I can. It's Evident Footprints that begins at 1 o'clock Eastern, and I listen to his show regularly. And was a guest on there a couple weeks ago. And I meant to mention this. I'm a guest on there this November 17th, which is Tuesday of this week. But anyway, I didn't know this, Jim, but I'd sent Don a copy of Psychological Illusions. And he reported in this show, he said he had had two near-death experiences. And in one of them, he had the experience in like a spiritual realm of these beings opening the book of life for him, like this sacred book. And there was the image of the Enneagram.
Wow.
And this was revealed to him in this kind of spiritual domain while he was going through a near-death experience. Isn't that amazing?
Wow. Yeah.
That's pretty good.
That's astounding. Holy mackerel, that's amazing.
I was shocked by it. I can see it's very conceivable to me. I see the Enneagram as like this symbol of sacred knowledge and its unknown origin. Gurdjieff says it can his system, the fourth way, dates from Egypt, but he says like pre-Egyptian times or an earlier phase of Egypt, which we've lost history of. That's kind of what he says about the origins of the fourth way. Even though he also says, he calls it at one point, he says, you could call it esoteric Christianity. But he says the Christianity that you think you know, in a way, much of the prayers and ritual of Christianity actually also derives from these earlier times in Egypt. So he's making that comment a little bit about the origins of Christianity, that it has a deeper history than simply the Christ story as we understand it, at least aspects of the Christian teaching. But anyway, that was shocking to hear Don Nikoloff say that about kind of perceiving the Enneagram in this spiritual domain. And he's very into music, eh, and language, and it was a very interesting show. Okay, but Jim, I thought today, like, to try to present some of this Gurdjieff teaching in a systematic way. When I used to teach at York University, and I was there for almost 12 years, I guess from 77 to 1990. And during that time, I developed a series of definitions of psychology based on Uspensky's explanations of the Gurdjieff teaching. And I had a listing of 8 definitions of psychology. And I thought today, Jim, we could begin by let's go through these. And we'll kind of go through these. And it's amazing for me to look back on this material I was teaching 30 years ago. And I see, like, how it's absolutely timeless. Like, it's not dated at all, eh? It's still far more advanced than anything I know in modern psychological theory after 30 years of studying. But it's like the material is almost timeless. And I think that's true because I see it as a system of objective thought. Because I think most of the theories and philosophies in modern times are subjective. It's according to a person's own conditioning and life experiences, the kind of their subjective formulations of life or the nature of self and so on. Whereas the idea from a mystical perspective is that certain human beings in life attain to higher levels of development, like an individual like Gurdjieff. So in a way, their teaching is described sometimes as originating outside of life, that in a way it's higher influences that and these teachings in a way are revealed. They come from above in the sense, so they're objective. They're not the subjective theories of Gurdjieff or Uspensky. Like, neither of those people would claim the fourth way ideas as their own. Gurdjieff wouldn't. Uspensky says in the fourth way, he says at the beginning, he says, if these were just my own subjective theories and ideas, they might be valuable, but it would be of limited value. And he explains that it seems to me this is a system of objective knowledge. And when I say objective, I mean the distinctions it makes correspond in some way to what exists in reality instead of a subjective kind of model of that. And we'll kind of go through some of these distinctions and such today. So that's you are familiar with all these definitions of psychology, Jim.
Yeah, and as you say, like, just on that note of objectivity, is that Maurice Nicol said that, who is a student of Uspensky and Gurdjieff, that esoteric teachings are a means for higher influences to reach us on Earth, and as you say, these are not ideas. I mean, that's the thing that when I first started studying the fourth way, is that I discerned a quality in these materials that they felt to me to be distinct from anything else that I'd ever studied or been introduced to, and that they have an objective quality. And as you say, these definitions were true 30 years ago, and they were true 75 years ago, and they'll be true 150 years from now too, because they describe something. They're not the product of a certain time or of a certain intellectual or cultural climate. They are objective in that sense. And I think, like you say, 35 years later, 30 years later, it seems timeless because they are timeless. And as I say, I believe these, that these are objective truths to it in the sense that to the extent that we can, in our subjective states of consciousness, can articulate objective truths, I think they certainly point to something important to try to understand in ourselves and in other people.
Yeah, good. So we'll work through these definitions today, and I'll introduce the definition, and give some angles on that definition, and then I'll turn it over to you, Jim, and you can elaborate on angles I bring up or contribute additional angles.
Sure.
Okay?
Yep.
Okay. And this is a chapter of my book called Psychological Illusions. And it's called Uspensky's. Is it called Uspensky's or just Definitions of Psychology?
Yeah.
They're drawn from Uspensky's writings. And in each case, he's saying, this is how to define psychology. This is what real psychology is. And he's giving a definition. Now, you have to realize at the time, I was in clinical psychology, and the standard definition of psychology is that psychology is the science of mind and behavior. Now, for 60 years, from about 1900s to about the 1960s, during that period, psychology was even more under behavioral influence, and at one point, psychology was defined as the science of behavior, that you could only study observable behavior in other living organisms. But then by the 1960s, kind of psychology expanded, and they realized that human beings do have a mind, and the psychologists could study the mind. It seems ridiculous that they thought they could avoid it. So anyway, at the time in the 1960s, and even today, psychology is defined as the science of behavior and the mind, which firstly defines a human being dualistically as having a mind and a body, or a psyche and a soma, okay? And it also excludes the ancient idea. If we look at the Greek meaning of the word psychology, psyche meant soul, and it was said that God breathed into man a living soul. So the psyche was the soul, but over time, because of the influence of Darwinian theory, we denied the existence of the human spirit or soul. And so in modern times, we don't think of psychology as the science of the soul. This has been lost for the past century of academic psychology and the clinical traditions, for the most part, even though there are exceptions like Carl Jung and others interested in the spiritual and psychic nature of mankind. But the mainstream of psychology is defined as the science of the behavior and the mind. Okay, so here we come, the first of Uspensky's definitions, and he says, quote, "The first answer to the question, what is psychology, should be that psychology is the study of the principles, laws, and facts of man's possible evolution." Okay, now firstly, Uspensky explains, he's not talking about physical evolution, what he calls the, quote, monkey to man business, which he denies the existence of that mechanical physical evolution. He says that is fraudulent. Okay. And then he explains, he says, historically, there have been these two traditions of psychology. And the one tradition, he says, it's been mixed up with religions and astrology and theosophy and spiritual studies. And he says that practically never in history has psychology stood at so low a level as at the present time. It has lost all touch with its origin and meaning. Some psychology is sometimes called a new science. This is quite wrong. Psychology is perhaps the oldest science, and unfortunately, in its most essential features, a forgotten science. So in the fourth way, the idea is that human beings can actually evolve in the development of their consciousness and being. And this isn't a physical evolution of the material body, a changing of the material form. It's rather the development and refinement of the inner being. That Gurdjieff says, for instance, there can be seven levels of human beings. Man number 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, or 7. He says most people in life are man number 1, 2, or 3. according to whether they are most determined by their physical, emotional, or mental natures. In Gurdjieff and Uspensky explained, for a person to attain to the next level of human evolution, they have to develop mentally, emotionally, and physically all three sides of their nature and bring these into harmony in a unified presence. And as this occurs, you have the emergence of this next state of consciousness, which they say is self-consciousness, based on the awakening of the experience of I within ourself. So a man number four is a person who's balanced their mental, emotional, and physical nature and is beginning to awaken to the experience of the I within themselves. A man number five is then described as a person in whom this I experience has become stabilized. So it's a constant state in them. And not that, Gurdjieff says, sometimes one doesn't need that full consciousness of self. But for man number five, that is available as required. And then four and five are someone developing and attaining the level of self-consciousness, which involves the evolution of consciousness from the state of waking sleep to the attainment of self-consciousness. And then a human being, number six or seven, is someone who then is opening and then solidifying the powers of the higher intellectual center, or of what Gurdjieff calls the highest being body, which is a person's mental or spiritual body. So a man number six or seven is someone who's attained their soul because they've developed their highest being body. Okay, I'll stop at that for a moment, Jim. There's so many different angles on any subject, sticking with the idea of psychology and related to the idea of human beings' possible evolution. Perhaps you might give another angle on that.
Well, yeah, as you say, well, just that first sentence, just there's so much contained within that because it sets off against all of modern psychology, this idea that psychology is properly to be understood to deal with the laws and principles of man's possible evolution. There's nothing in modern psychology which recognizes the idea of transformation and of conscious evolution or the evolution of consciousness. So even in that one sentence, there's so much in that itself. And then as Uspensky goes on to say that all the psychology first of all, that psychology is not a modern science. It wasn't invented in Wilhelm Wundt's laboratory in the 1870s, which is typically how it's represented in modern thought, but rather that it's the oldest science, or perhaps the oldest science, and that you can divide all psychologies into those which take man as he is, or rather as people suppose him to be, or in terms of what he can become through the process of conscious evolution. And just in that basic distinction, everything is put on an entirely different footing. It's hard to kind of grasp how important that is until you begin to study the idea, until you start to flesh it out and see what he means by the psychology of man's possible evolution. But not evolution in terms of, as you say, it's not mechanical evolution. It's not evolution as we understand it in terms of modern thought, but rather evolution through the conscious effort to transform one's consciousness. And that depends on an esoteric teaching as a guide.
Yeah, and then he's saying that we actually acquire new powers and capacities as this evolution takes place. And as you say, modern psychology has no compatible formulation. Like, modern psychologists think that a person can grow, develop, mature, self-actualize, but they don't have this idea of evolution, that we can actually attain a different level of the quality of our being in the way Gurdjieff means it. And here's another quote from Gurdjieff. He says, "The evolution of man is the evolution of his consciousness, and consciousness cannot evolve unconsciously. The evolution of man is the evolution of his will, and will cannot evolve involuntarily. The evolution of man is the evolution of his power of doing, and doing cannot be the result of things which happen." So not only is Gurdjieff suggesting something completely different in the notion of evolution, like it's not physical evolution, he's saying there's an actual physical growth and refinement of the inner being, that a person actually can develop and attain these higher being bodies. But it requires an effort on their part. It's not just something that will happen. And again, there's no comparable concepts in modern psychology or science. It's like everybody wants, you know, the world to turn enough time that all of a sudden everybody will awaken and it'll all just happen and the heavens will open up and it'll all be revealed to us. And from the Gurdjieff perspective, no, we have to make an effort to awaken and to attain real will. So the evolution of a human being is not something that can happen. It's something you have to make conscious efforts to strive towards.
Yeah, I guess, I'm just thinking a little bit about this in terms of, you know, at the beginning you quoted Uspensky when he said that at that time that psychology was at its lowest point in many, many years. And I think that was probably written around the time of that behaviorism had become ascendant in Western psychology. And so everything that he's saying there about the two psychologies, about the, you know, the psychology of man's possible evolution versus the psychology of man as he is, or rather as people suppose him to be, it speaks to the idea that within psychology, within the study of psychology, under the behaviorists, the idea of consciousness was completely banned. There just wasn't any recognition of consciousness. It was an internal state, and John Watson, who was the creator, the progenitor of behaviorism, said that we have to do away, if we're going to study psychology scientifically, we have to do away with such unapproachables he has another word like that, unapproachables and indefinables as consciousness. And so consciousness had been cast out of psychology. But even in the further psychological theorizing and even psychoanalytic theorizing, you always have the simplistic division between just consciousness is generally defined very vaguely as just the waking state, and then there's sleep, and there's two basic conscious states. Or the great discovery of Freud and psychoanalysis is the idea of the importance of the unconscious. But there's really no recognition that in the waking state that is possible to attain and make permanent a higher state of consciousness. That idea doesn't exist within Western psychology, and that's the basic premise of all esoteric psychologies. Like when Uspensky is discussing like alchemy and magic and all these different theosophy, all these different teachings, he's saying these were all psychological teachings which had in mind the idea of trying to develop consciousness so that people could attain to a higher state of consciousness than that which is we know in the normal waking state. So it begins with this fundamental esotericism and mysticism begins with from this fundamentally different starting place, which is that they recognize that the evolution of consciousness is possible, and that evolution involves the attainment of a higher state of consciousness and being, and something that can be realized permanently, not something that's transitory, but something that actually can become permanent within an individual. And see, that just doesn't exist in any Western psychological teaching. So, as you say, people will talk about self-actualizing and integration, but self-fulfillment, but they don't mean it they mean it horizontally, they don't mean it vertically, they don't mean there'll be a qualitative change to a higher state of consciousness.
Yeah. Okay, so we'll move on. Second definition, that psychology involves the study of language, And this is very interesting because the fourth way teaching provides a very exacting language. And a lot of the terms in it are the terms we use all the time. Words like I, will, consciousness, thinking, feeling, standard terms, but they're defined more precisely in the context of ideas and teachings. So Gurdjieff compares modern life. He says, people don't understand each other at all. You think you understand these people you read, and you don't really understand them. Everybody uses language differently. One person, by thinking, they think their thoughts are feelings, and another person takes feelings to be thoughts, and there's all this confusion about consciousness and confusion about what I is and what will is, all these basic terms. So they're saying we have to get beyond this tower of Babel where everyone has a different language and learn a more objective language. And he says to any people who know this language, they have a much more precise language for sharing ideas about these subtle psychological processes. And we certainly see that, Jim, that there's certainly a very valuable language in the fourth way.
Yeah. I don't know if you're going to get into this, but something you touched on before when you were talking about the seven levels of man, and Gurdjieff relates all of that to everything. Like there's seven different levels of man. There's seven different types of religion. There's seven different types of art. There's seven different types of knowledge. And he says that that when he's talking about the language, he says that within his system, the language that we use isn't really based on any new nomenclature or specific terms that are unusual, but rather are all based on one principle, and that's of relativity. And so, like within Gurdjieff's teaching, you have these different levels of consciousness and being that apply psychologically and cosmologically, and everything is related within his system to this idea. Where does it fit? Where does any term fit? Like he says, take the example of man. And so he talks about the seven different types of man. You have a physical man, and you have an emotional man, you have an intellectual man, but these are all people who are asleep. But then you have a fourth level of man, and that's somebody who's started to develop a permanent center of gravity within himself and a permanent sense of I. Then you have a fifth man who's higher yet and who is more integrated, more permanent. And he talks, and you can talk about worlds. He says, he has this cosmological scheme in which there are seven different levels of reality in the universe. He calls it the Ray of Creation, which descends from the absolute to the moon. And so you go through these different levels, and each of these levels cosmologically involves a different level of consciousness and being, and that they're stepped down and inform the levels below it. And so he says everything can be placed within the scheme based on this principle of relativity. So you have seven different levels of religion, and seven different levels of knowledge, and that's, I think, what it's very hard to just sort of hear this and say, oh yeah, I get that, because you won't get it, because you have to begin to study yourself and to see these different levels in people, and to begin to appreciate that, oh, there are people who are more awake than other people, and that there are, in life, there are different types, that we're all asleep, but we're asleep in different ways. And then you have to kind of recognize the idea of how this could apply at a cosmological level, and then you have to unite the psychological with the cosmological and see how each informs the other and completes the other. And then gradually, though, it's like it's the teaching sort of like a solution that you develop photographs in. It's like it's something that you put ideas into, and they emerge, and they become more detailed and coherent and comprehensive, and you start to see connections with other things within the teaching. But all of it is like the specific idea of language is like, as he says, it's not that the words are different, it's that they're based on a different principle. It's that this principle of relativity, that everything has its place in terms of its the principle applies to the possible evolution, the level of evolution possible for it, so that you can place anything within his scheme and in terms of where it fits in sort of the evolutionary ladder and what's possible for it in terms of its development. And it's, as I say, it's impossible to hear that and really grasp it, but that's the basic idea, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's a very valuable language, and if you know this language, it also gives you keys to understanding other literature. And we'll come to examples of it as we move along. Okay, the third definition of psychology, Uspensky writes, serious study begins in this system with the study of oneself, because psychology cannot be studied as astronomy can outside oneself. A man has to study himself. When I was told that, I saw at once that we do not have any methods of studying ourselves and always have many wrong ideas about ourselves. So I realized that we must get rid of wrong ideas about ourselves and at the same time find methods for studying ourselves. And one would think, in a way, this would be so obvious to anyone studying psychology that we would need to study ourselves. And historically, you see different examples of psychologists who do study themselves in various ways, and that's how they arrive at their theories. It is likely based on being aware of various aspects of their experience. But none of them have a system, like a systematic way of studying themselves. And here's another quote from Uspensky. He says, to know ourselves, this was the first principle of psychology and first demand of all psychological schools. We still remember these words, but have lost their meaning. We think that to know ourselves means to know our peculiarities, our desires, our tastes, our capacities, and our intention, when in reality, it means to know yourself as machines. That is to know the structure of one's machine, its parts, functions of different parts, the conditions governing their work, and so on. Okay, so, and here it's interesting because in my view of what it means to know thyself, I see it as a multi-stepped kind of process. And in a way, like, I think in common life, people think they know themselves. You ask most people, how well do you think you know yourself? And most people think they know themselves very well or pretty well. Okay, but that, in a way, is like they're knowing what Gurdjieff describes as their peculiarities, desires, tastes, and so on. So then Uspensky suggests the next level of knowing yourself is to know yourself as a machine, what the parts of your machine are, how those parts work together, what the states of consciousness are, and so on. But then I think the aim of this, I think that knowing yourself as a machine is then a transitional phase, and that what we want to attain in terms of knowing ourselves is direct experience of our I and direct, we see what we want to know is the hidden nature of self. So what it's like studying ourselves as a machine is like studying the normal psychology, and then once you've acquired that, the aim is to get to the level of knowing yourself beyond the level of the machine, like what the real I is. Hey, Jim, I'll throw it over to you.
Well, again, you know, I think you're right on in terms of what you said about, you know, you can take these different levels of knowing yourself. What, do you know yourself? Well, yeah, I know my, you know, I like Thai food and baseball, and, you know, people have these very superficial understandings of what it means to know themselves. And if you ask people if they know themselves, yeah, I know myself pretty well. One thing I don't know is why I'm always late for everything. That was an example of one of the things you cited, where they asked people if they knew themselves. But people generally have that idea. But that's a first discovery when you begin to systematically study yourself. That's what we found in terms of the fourth way, is that you don't know yourself. You don't understand how mechanical you are. You don't know the parts of your machine. You don't know how your machine is broken. But prolonged study of yourself in those terms leads to a more a more startling discovery is that there, beyond that, there is a self, but it's something quite that you didn't even quite imagine before, that there is this hidden depth of the self, which is far beyond anything that is identified within modern psychology and is beyond anything that we normally sense, and that as you say, this is the transition from the normal psychology to the supernormal psychology, and it's extraordinarily eye opening, and in a sense, there's in the fact that people have this experience over and over again, I think it confirms, it validates that this is an empirical scientific study of psychology. Like, people are prescribed certain methods, they follow them, they get certain results, which are consistently reported within the laboratories throughout the world, throughout the ages of our own consciousness and being, so that at least a very different idea of what psychology can be.
Yeah, and it's interesting. It's like if you are in a study group, like we used to have at York University, where people were making an effort to self-remember. And we would all come back reporting similar insights and experiences. It was like we shared that understanding of what it meant to be self-remembering.
Yeah.
Okay, just one other thing. I'm going through the chapters of my book, drawing elements here and there. I noticed Uspensky says, there is no question of faith or belief in all this. Quite the opposite. This system teaches people to believe in absolutely nothing. You must verify everything that you see, hear, and feel. Only in that way can you come to something. And I think this is one aspect of the fourth way teaching that so appealed to me as an academic and scientist and seeker after truth, is that this isn't a system of believing in it. In fact, Uspensky says, if you believe in it, it's useless to you. It's no use believing. What you've got to do is learn the ideas and then have concrete experiences and observations and experiences that validate or verify those concepts. So the idea isn't to believe any of it. It's not a way of belief, which is more like a religion of a man number two, is like sentimentality and belief and faith. Okay. Whereas Uspensky is saying, this isn't a system like that. This is a scientific and objective system, and you have to verify what's being said. Otherwise, it's of no use to you. All it is information you store in your brain about what someone else says. But you've got all that information, but you've never verified that data. You have no substantive being experiences to validate what's being described.
Yeah,
so that's a very important aspect of the fourth way. It's a study of ourselves. It's not a belief system. But it's like we all become our own psychological laboratory.
Yeah, and as Gurdjieff says, the fourth way is a path of understanding. It's, you have to understand these things, and you begin by understanding them. You can understand them in others, and you can understand them in yourself. But Gurdjieff said, like, people have this susceptibility to believe in what he calls any old tale, and he said it's absolutely useless for you just to believe any of this. You have to understand it, and as you say, as for us as Westerners and as scientists, like, this had great appeal because I would not at that time have been in any way attracted to a system, a belief system, which is a system of faith, because I didn't have faith in the traditional sense of it. And yet, the odd thing is that this has created faith in me in the sense of believing in things that can't be seen. In a deeper sense of faith.
Yeah, more as how Gurdjieff says faith can be what he calls one of the genuine sacred emotions or higher feelings.
Yeah.
He sees faith, hope, and love are sacred being impulses.
Impulses, yeah.
But it's not like just faith in anything that you're told to believe in. It's faith based on something else you're direct experiences and deep knowledge, I think, is intuitive to our own hearts. And if we connect with that, then we have faith. We know there's something more because, in a way, we believe, we feel it in our hearts. So it's not just belief because you've been told, but it's belief based on that inner experience of being.
Yeah, and to just to touch on that point briefly, it's like that's what in part two, like what I was talking before about the principle of relativity and that this hierarchy of different levels, it's that you can have the faith in the sense of that we normally, when somebody says they have faith, it's like what they're really describing is that they've been taught and they've learned and they've been conditioned to believe in certain things, and so they believe in them. So that's a certain type of faith, you know, and that's more a faith of the lower normal waking consciousness. But then there's a faith of an entirely different nature, which is, it's led to through certain processes of self-study and self-discovery and of development within oneself. But eventually it crystallizes in like this higher level of understanding where you don't have to have, you don't have to be able to see or sense something directly to believe in its reality. It's kind of struggling to articulate this, but it's like, as you, what you described, it's like it's a higher level faith. So again, there's this basic idea, like it's the same word, it's faith, but it has two completely different meanings depending on what type of faith do you mean. Like, I don't have faith in the sense of, like, I'll believe in something because as a Presbyterian I was educated to believe that I'm going to go to heaven when I die. I don't relate to that, but I do have faith in terms of believing in spiritual realities and a creator. But it's got nothing to do with it, you know, it didn't come from being conditioned or believing. It comes from a coherent attempt to try to put in order the facts of my experience through the study of myself and through the exposure to these other ideas, like these esoteric ideas. Now I have a very different sense of what it means to have faith.
Yeah. And direct experiences, like I think for both of us at different times in our life, having out-of-body experiences was very significant.
Yeah, and like, altered states of consciousness.
Was very important. At a certain point in my life, I had an out-of-body experience, and when that happened to me, it's like it led me to uncover when I thought I was a child, I used to be able to astral travel. And I used to have memories of this, and I'd forgotten all about that. I'd, like, forgotten it for 10 years from when I was a younger boy. And then all of a sudden I remembered, and I had all these remembrances of experiences as a child. I used to remember waking up in my body, and it felt like my whole body, like every muscle was tense, and my body felt so knotted up. And I couldn't, and it was a horrible feeling kind of coming into my body, and I never could understand what that was. And then later, I realized that, oh, that experience must have been, likely have been my reconnecting with my body and how uncomfortable and gross the body felt on coming back into it.
Oh, that's really interesting. I've never heard you say that before. That's very interesting.
I think I described that time when I was with Cynthia and I woke up in the middle of the night and I thought the bed was up on the top of the ceiling and I was kind of against the ceiling and I had to ask, say, we got to get the bed down on the floor. And then I realized, oh, I was out of my body. And then that led to the kind of recovery of these memories I had not consciously suppressed. I'd just completely forgotten about it. Like some of this inner awareness of being, I think, fades from people as we grow older and we're conditioned and educated and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
But we'll move on. The next, it's so interesting how all these definitions are interrelated too. Okay,
yeah.
The next one, Uspensky explains that psychology must involve the study of the centers. And he says, quote, "We do not realize that there are independent beings in us, independent minds." Now, at the time, I was in the mainstream of Western psychology, and the view as it is today, 30 years later, is that a human being has one mind, and it's in the head. And then some psychologists, well, think you have two minds. You have the kind of left hemisphere and the right hemisphere. But the general idea or concept is you have a mind in the head and you have a body, two parts. Okay. Whereas Gurdjieff explains it completely different. He says, in reality, you have seven minds within you. Okay. Even though he begins by explaining it more differently and saying a human being has both a threefold and a sevenfold nature. Okay. So the threefoldness, and this is the terminology he uses in Beelzebub's Tales, because he always refers to the three-brained beings on planet Earth, and they function mentally, emotionally, and physically. So you have an intellectual center centered in the head, in the mind. You have an emotional center, which is connected both to an organ in the region of the breast by Beelzebub, which is the heart, and it's related to the autonomic nervous system. So the autonomic nervous system is a nervous system completely, well, not completely, but quite independent of what's called the central nervous system. Like the brain in the head is part of the central nervous system, and it's enclosed in bone. But the autonomic nervous system, it runs down, the tracks run down parallel to the spinal column, but outside of the spinal column, and tracks from the autonomic nervous system, they go to the heart, to the adrenal glands, to the lungs, to all different organs and glands of the body. So you have this autonomic nervous system, and Gurdjieff says that's the basis of emotional experience. Okay, and this contrasts with modern scientists who think that emotional experiences involve midbrain structures, like the amygdala and the fornix body and so on in the midbrain. Okay, whereas Gurdjieff is saying, no, we experience emotions through our body. Like if you can feel anxious, you feel it in your solar plexus. So you actually experience the anxiety in your solar plexus. You may think about it in your head, or you can be aware in your head of the feeling in your solar plexus, but the actual feeling center has its own brain. It's okay. So we think we have one mind, but Gurdjieff saying no, you have the intellectual center, the emotional center, and the third he calls sometimes the moving instinctual center, and its brain is in the spinal column. And so he's saying we actually have three spiritualized brains. That's how Gurdjieff explains it. But then he breaks those three down to seven, because you take first the physical man or woman, and he breaks the physical nature down into the instinctual center, which means your capacities for sensation and all the biological processes that go on in the body, all things which are unlearned. They're part of the instinctual, biological nature of the planetary body. So that's instinctual center. Like a person, you eat the food and you sit down and you say, I think I'm going to digest my food. But no one in this audience knows how to digest food. Your body digests the food. It's all instinctive. We have no concept of how it really works, except through science. Okay, and the third part of the physical the moving center is all learnt movement. Okay, and so the moving instinctual center are often discussed together because it's like the sensory motor nature of a human being. And if you look at the spinal cord, you see all the sensory nerves feed in on one side and the motor nerves feed out on the other side. So the sensory the instinctual moving center actually is part of the physical body. And there's two components to that. And the third part of the physical man is the sexual center. And Gurdjieff, the sexual center is connected to the genitals and to the hormones that circulate through the blood. So each of those centers has its own physical basis. And then, so Gurdjieff says that really there are five centers responsible for all the normal functioning of a human being: the instinctual, the moving, the sexual, the emotional, and the intellectual. And if a person brings those into alignment, Gurdjieff says that person can lock the pentagram in themselves. And the pentagram is a five-pointed star, and it represents, for Gurdjieff, the example, it represents the perfected physical man. Okay, and then Gurdjieff says, finally, there are two higher centers, the higher emotional center and the higher intellectual center. But those centers involve the development of consciousness, and we have to attain to those centers. And that's part of the fourth way teaching, is that as we are, we use only our lower centers, and we use only the mechanical parts of centers. Like Gurdjieff also says that every center has an intellectual, emotional, and moving part. Okay, the same pattern is repeated within each center. And so in the fourth way teaching, we try to learn what the centers are, what their subdivisions are, and then we try to apply this in practical self-observation, where you label these things in your own awareness. You realize, oh, this is my emotion, and where you feel it, and how you feel it, and what emotions are, and how that differs from the mind. And so we begin to observe, we study the centers. These are the parts of our being. So, yeah, we study these to study ourselves as a machine. Jim, any comments on the concept of centers?
Well, yeah, that's good. I mean, just this idea that we have these, I mean, for practical purposes, we have these three different brains. If we take the moving, instinctual, sexual centers, just the physical center, we have these three different brains, the intellectual, emotional, and physical brains in ourselves, and that each of these centers has its own peculiarities, in the sense that it has its own speed of operation, which is very important, like, that they operate at different speeds, and its own type of memory. And I think, again, this speaks to kind of a lot of the problems in terms of modern psychology and understanding memory, is that I think this is an aspect of memory that's not generally acknowledged or understood very well, and that they have their own distinct functions, but that the centers operate improperly due to what Gurdjieff calls wrong work, but that we have these three independent minds within ourselves, and each of them can function with varying degrees of consciousness. So you can be more or less conscious in any one center at any one time, and that he says we don't understand how integrally related these three centers are, how they depend upon one another, how they influence one another. And he says, there's a quote from him that says, "The attitude of your body corresponds to your sentiments and to your thoughts. A change in your emotions will inevitably produce a corresponding change in your mental attitude and in your physical pose. A change of thought will start another current of emotional energy, which will naturally change the physical posture. So that if we want to alter our ways of feeling and our forms of thinking, we must first change our moving postures, and at the same time, without changing our emotional and mental postures, it is impossible for us to acquire new moving postures. We cannot change one without changing the other." And I think that touches on something very important, is that as you study, as you said, through the process of self-observation, you begin to observe your centers functioning in your day-to-day activities, and you realize that this is very, there's this very complicated dance going on within yourself all the time, and that just as he says, like, physical postures are dependent upon your emotions and your thoughts, and your thoughts are dependent upon your emotions and your physical postures, and each is dependent on one another, and they influence one another, and it's very complicated and much more difficult to sort of tease out what's actually going on. The more you study, the more you realize how incredibly complex things are, but at the same time you realize the value of this idea of rather than just thinking that in terms of modern psychology, that we consist of a mind and a body, that there's a real utility to trying to understand yourself as having these three distinct centers of intelligence or brains within oneself, and to try to understand their operation. It's a very It's a very different scheme, and it requires a certain considerable amount of study to apply this scheme to begin to see its real value, but it is a very different way of trying to understand yourself and to know yourself.
It's such a valuable scheme in so many ways, and it's like, in a way, if we use the term schizophrenia, which people often use, and the term schizophrenia actually means split mind, and in a way, fourth way gives us a perspective on that, because there can be splitting between the centers within a person. Because what tends to happen is, as false ego grows, the intellectual center in mind becomes more and more predominant. Well, actually, that's not quite true. But whereas the essence and the real self is more connected to the emotional center, and that tends to be split off, and that can pass into the unconscious. But the basic point I'm trying to make is that there can be splitting within a person, where you feel one thing, think another, and act in the third way. It's like these different competing independent minds within the same being. And
yeah.
It's a very valuable perspective. And then when you begin to study the centers, it's not only studying the centers separately, but also how they influence each other. For example, I might be aware of that I'm centered in my mind thinking about things. But then when I might look at my thoughts and say perhaps my thoughts are about that attractive blonde I saw at the cafe today. Well, then what it's likely is that my sexual center is controlling my mind because she aroused my sexual interest. So that my I'm using my mind, but my mind is really being controlled by these sexual feelings. Or I might be thinking about emotional conflicts I'm having. Gurdjieff explains that most of the time, the intellectual center is being controlled by the sex center, the instinctual center, or the moving or emotional. Very seldom, he says, do people use the intellectual center as purely an intellectual center. Most of the time, it's controlled by lower centers. So as Jim mentioned, the concept of what Gurdjieff calls the wrong work of centers, which we'll come to later. And there's many instances of this wrong work of centers. So it's a very productive way to see a human being, not to think of us as unified individuals, but really as having these different aspects within one person that we have to bring into alignment so that we develop what Gurdjieff would call a completed presence, which is where you're aware simultaneously, mentally, emotionally, and physically in the fullness of now. We want to get to that point where we complete our presence and we can maintain a state of wakefulness, awake mentally, emotionally, and physically simultaneously. Okay, whereas normally all your different centers are doing different things and all their activities are for the most part always mechanical. It's how you've been conditioned and your habit structures and so on. So we begin to study the centers, it's studying the mechanicalness of your activity in different centers. Like, say, for instance, say you're learning to drive a car. And when you drive a car, when you begin to drive a car, you have to use your mind to guide your behavior. So you say, if you have to depress the clutch, you say to yourself, take your foot off the gas, put the clutch in, change gears, let the clutch out, give it gas. And initially, when you're learning something like driving, you're trying to direct your movement with your mind in your head. But once the movement is learnt, it can be done completely by the moving instinctual center. And you don't even have to think. Once you become habitual to driving, you can drive all over the place. You don't have to think anymore about how to drive. You don't have to think, okay, what do I do? Pushing the clutch. You don't think that anymore. It's all in moving instinctual memory. The study of the centers provides a lot of practical insights into oneself. Okay, so The next definition of psychology is psychology must start with the study of consciousness. And here, Uspensky was particularly critical of the American philosopher and psychologist William James, who was very influential in the development of the modern Western psychology of consciousness. And Uspensky said of William James, Uspensky wrote, in conversational language and in everyday psychology, even in psychology purporting to be scientific, the word consciousness is often used as a term for the designation of a complex of all psychic functions in general or for their separate manifestations. To the best of my recollection, Professor William James defined thought as a moment of consciousness. And in Western psychology, William James was very influential. William James once wrote, by states of consciousness are meant such things as sensations, desires, emotions, cognitions, reasoning, decisions, volition, and the like. The first and foremost concrete fact, which everyone will affirm, is the fact that consciousness of some sort goes on. We must simply say that thought goes on. Let us call it the stream of thought, of consciousness, or of subjective life. Now here, what Uspensky is saying is that William James is confusing consciousness with what Uspensky would call the psychological functions. Consciousness is not thinking. Consciousness is not emotions. Consciousness is not sensations. Those are psychic functions. They're psychological functions produced by the centers, by the different minds, okay, the intellectual, emotional, and moving instinctual mind. But consciousness is something different, and he compares it to two things. Firstly, he says it's like a background upon which things are revealed. And he also compares consciousness to light. It's like the machine. Yeah, the consciousness is light. And because there's this inner light, that allows us to be aware of what's on our mind, or aware of what we're feeling, or aware of sensation. But the awareness is not the thinking. It is not the emotions. It is not the sensations. See, consciousness is something significantly different. It's more the background, or it's like light. Hey, Jim, I'll give you a chance here. Are you there, Jim?
I'm trying to figure out what to say.
I just kind of dropped you off in the middle of the stream. There's a lot more we could say about the study of consciousness. So that was one. That, to me, was very significant 35 years ago, that distinction that consciousness is separate from the psychological functions. Because I could see how all of Western psychology of consciousness was making exactly the mistake that Uspensky was talking about. Like in modern psychology, they began to equate consciousness with thinking and the stream of associative thoughts that go on in the mind all the time. Whereas from the fourth way perspective, that stream of associative thinking that goes on in people all the time is an obstacle to attaining consciousness. So not only is it not consciousness, but that minding activity is an obstacle to the awakening of consciousness.
Yeah, and because the other part of it, too, is that metaphor that James used, the stream of consciousness, is really, it's become kind of part of the general assumptive framework of almost everybody in Western psychology who talks about consciousness. So there's a stream, and then there's the contents, and it can be thinking, it can be thoughts, it can be feelings, sensations, imagination, all sorts of different contents, and the focus tends to always be on the contents, and as you say quite rightly, the emphasis tends to be on thought. But what that misses is that because consciousness is equated with the psychological functions, that means that really the normal waking state is seen as some sort of as qualitatively as one thing, and there's no recognition that consciousness is a variable property. And like Gurdjieff says, in contrast, is that your principal mistake is thinking that you're always conscious or that you can be. And that really, if you observe consciousness in yourself, you'll see there's this great variability. And he further relates that variability of consciousness to each of the centers. Like, it's possible to be more or less conscious in each of the centers. And then, so really, what his system is saying is that the level and intensity and duration of consciousness are all variable, and that they're related to the three centers, and so that you can have either one or two or three of the centers in which you're more or less conscious for various lengths of time and for various intensities, in various intensities. Whereas in Western psychology, that's all sort of smeared out, and all you have really is this focus on the contents, and especially on cognitive processes as being equated with consciousness. So really, like, almost everything in Western psychology has taken the study of consciousness away from consciousness and invested it all in the psychological function. As you say, the irony of all this is that in all of Eastern teachings and all esoteric and mystical teachings, one of the primary obstacles is this mechanical associative thinking is the primary obstacle to the development of consciousness. And it's really peculiar in terms of the separation of Western psychology from the esoteric and mystical traditions, how they've completely missed this. It's just so extraordinary that there's been no recognition of this, that people haven't twigged to this. It's like, you know, people do know something about consciousness. They have studied it for thousands of years. Western psychologists seem to pretend that nobody ever studied consciousness before they did, and so they've just basically missed these most fundamental ideas about the proper study of consciousness.
Yeah, and instead made all these fundamental mistakes.
Yeah.
I see what has happened is that in the West, the scientists who study consciousness study it predominantly with their intellectual mind.
Yeah.
And then they end up thinking that their consciousness, they equate the consciousness with their minding activity. Like,
yeah,
if someone wants to study consciousness, they think what they got to do is think about it and have theories and so on. And what they don't do is try to study consciousness directly within themselves.
This is so ironic because in Western psychology, what we've become aware of in experimental psychology is what are called experimenter effects and demand characteristics. So how even in trying to be objective, researchers often inadvertently interject themselves into the experimental process and contaminate the results. But nobody seems to recognize that this is going on all the time in theorizing about consciousness, that they don't realize how the thinking activity is reinforcing this misperception that consciousness equals thinking, or consciousness equals contents of awareness, which is essentially thinking. And it's so ironic that this has been missed.
Yeah, and it's interesting also how when Gurdjieff explains what self-remembering is, which we'll come to in a moment, where you're trying to develop your consciousness. When you remember, Gurdjieff wants an individual to bring their attention, firstly, into self-sensing, which means sensing their physicalness, anchoring their consciousness in the awareness of the planetary body. So, it's like suspending that continual process of associative thinking that goes on in the mind all the time. That's what most people identify themselves with, and their ego and their mind, is this continual process of associative thinking. And it reminds me of what Yogananda says about, defines yoga as the science of mind control. And he says, we try to achieve union by suspending the processes of the associative thinking or the thought streams that go on in the mind all the time. So the idea is really this associative thinking is actually an obstacle to consciousness instead of really being what consciousness involves. And Gurdjieff, in the practice of self-remembering, is encouraging us to bring our consciousness, anchor it in your awareness of your physical body. Like when I self-remember, I'll try to feel myself in my hands and my feet and all through my body as a whole at once simultaneously to anchor my awareness into my physical nature. So those are some comments on the study of consciousness. And another thing that's so important there is this idea that consciousness can only be studied through self-study. And that, to me, 35 years ago, I'd never heard anyone say that. Like in everything I was reading about the nature of consciousness, no one ever says you got to study it in yourself. And I realized, oh, of course, we can only be conscious of our own consciousness. We can never perceive or observe another person's inner awareness of being. So, of course, we have to study consciousness in ourselves. And this is the basic, how could you imagine having a study, a science of consciousness, which doesn't begin by studying it within yourself? And that is an idea kind of completely missed by modern psychology. And I still see no one in the mainstream of psychology who has even such a basic concept of studying consciousness in ourself by trying to become more conscious.
Yeah, and what that leads to, and this sort of connects with our next definition, but is also is that by studying consciousness in yourself, with getting back to that point I made earlier about that, you know, that there's this variability of consciousness, is that it's possible to become more self-conscious. And Uspensky, this is from your book, actually, under that definition, says that Uspensky says, the first obstacle in the way of the development of self-consciousness in man is his conviction that he already possesses self-consciousness, or at any rate that he can have it at any time he likes. It is very difficult to persuade a man that he is not conscious and cannot be conscious at will. And this is a further extension of what you're saying about the study of consciousness within yourself, is that we have this conceit, this presumption that we're self-conscious beings, or that we can at any time be self-conscious. It's just a matter of us wanting to be. But what self-study reveals is that to be self-conscious is very difficult, and in fact, it's very rare, and that most of the time we're in this state of what Gurdjieff calls waking sleep, where we're not really self-conscious, where we're automatically and mechanically ruled by our associations and our conditioning, and there's very little consciousness in almost everything we think, act, and feel. You can't figure that out by studying other people. You can only really know that by studying it yourself. It's impossible. It's like, you know, you can't... you can't find gold in a copper mine, and you can't, you know, see microbes by looking at the stars. You have to look in the proper place to find certain things. And you know, we can't study consciousness in other people. It's most directly observable, and really only observable in yourself. And yet, the other side of it too, of course, is that once you begin to understand consciousness in yourself, you can understand it in other people more thoroughly.
Yeah. Yeah, okay, so this all leads to the next definition of Uspensky's, which is that psychology begins with the practice of what is called self-remembering. And this is a process. What this practice entails is so subtle and complex that if a person in your life begins to self-remember, as you do it over time, your understanding of this is refined more and more. But basically, the idea, as you go about your life, whenever you remember to do it, anywhere, at any time, you try to bring your attention back to being present here now and being aware of what's going on around you and what's going on within you, within your different centers. And at those moments, what you're trying to do is enhance that state of wakefulness in this moment. So if someone joins or studies the fourth way, as you go about your life, you have these moments. You start trying to remember yourself. So you go about your life. You might be riding in the car, and all of a sudden you remember yourself. So you try to become aware of what you're doing and sensing yourself and being aware of what's on your mind. And then you try to let that go and just be in that state of heightened wakefulness. And you begin by studying yourself by trying to have these moments of self-remembering through a day. And what you begin to realize very quickly is you can't remember to self-remember. Because you decide, oh, I'm going to try to remember myself today. And then the phone goes and you pick up the phone and it's a friend of yours and you got to do this and that today. And then you start thinking about that and you think about your feelings towards that friend. And then you got these things on your mind and you do one thing after another all day long. And you completely forget the whole time about your intention to self-remember. Because there is no constant I. There's no I that says, I'm going to remember myself today and then self-remember through the day. You can't do it. One little I sets an intention, I'm going to self-remember, and 5 minutes now, you've completely forgotten about it. See, this is partly how you begin to study consciousness. You begin to study how you cannot remember to be self-aware, how instead all the time you have these patterns of associative activities going on in your mind, in your emotions, and your other centers, and you're completely embedded and caught up with those processes of conditioned activity. And you can never remember to be aware of I simultaneously. So you might, for instance, in the fourth way, we try to struggle with negative emotions, like become aware of negative emotions when they arise, and we try to work through them and let them go. So we want to be free of negative emotions. But what happens when you have a negative emotion, you just feel that negative emotion, and you feel it's right, and you think it's thoughts, and it takes over you. And while you're in a state of negative emotion, you can't remember to self-remember and observe yourself because you're in a state of identification, which for Gurdjieff is the opposite of self-remembering, where in the state of identification, you take your thoughts and your feelings and your sensations, you take them always as I, whereas in self-remembering, it's like we're trying to separate I from it. And it is your thoughts and feelings. So the I is trying to be aware of what goes on inside yourself. You start observing your own patterns of thinking and feeling and activity. So self-remembering, Uspensky writes, psychology begins at this point. Man does not remember himself, but could remember himself if he made sufficient efforts. Without self-remembering, there can be no study, no psychology. So this is self-remembering is a method we use to try to study what consciousness is within ourselves. And we do it partly by trying to remember to be conscious and then see how we can't do it. Because most of the time we're in this relative conscious state where we're thinking and feeling and acting, but we're just completely caught up in those activities. And there's no simultaneous awareness of I in relationship to those activities. It's all a very subtle and complex process, Jim, self-remembering. I remember when at York we used to have groups and people would work at self-remembering through the week and we'd always be sharing our understanding. And you could see how everyone over time would refine their understanding of it.
Yeah, self-remembering is a lot like consciousness in the sense that the more you study it, the more you realize that, you know, the more elusive it becomes in a sense, but also that the deeper your understanding of it becomes, and it always does seem to change your understanding of what you're actually doing. But in its most basic sense, like the idea that you try to have the state of presence where there's a part of you that's just aware that I am here. So I am here speaking to you on the radio, or I am here listening to the radio, and these guys talk about the fourth way. It's hard to sustain that. It's hard, as you say, it's completely impossible to remember to remember. You forget, and you caught up in whatever captures your attention, and you forget your intention to remember yourself, and you realize through this process that you have all these little different eyes in you, and that they're all sort of evoked by different experiences, but there's no one central eye that's master of yourself and which you can rely on. That sentence that you quoted from Uspensky, I think, is probably, there's more wisdom in that sentence about, you know, that psychology begins with the realization that you can't remember yourself, but that with continued practice and study, you it is possible to do so, is whatever, something to that effect. There's more wisdom in that than there is, and you could take all the journals of psychology in the Western world, and there's nothing nothing compares in importance to that statement, because really self-remembering is the ultimate psychological experiment, I think, because it reveals so much about the nature of consciousness, the nature of I, the nature of self, and the continued attempt to practice it changes everything. When Gurdjieff had his groups with Uspensky in Russia, when he introduced the idea of self-remembering, he asked at one of their meetings, he said, "What's the most important thing that you've observed in your study of yourself?" And everybody had a different answer and touched on different things. And Uspensky said, "I could sense that he was dissatisfied with our answers." And he said, "Not one of you has observed the most important thing that I've told you. Not one of you has seen that when things happen, that not one of you has observed that with everything, it thinks, it acts, it feels. It's not I act, I think, I feel. You don't exist in your observations of yourself, and in which case, what good are they? It's always that you're always, there's this it, and rather than your I. And as you say, like when we were first studying this, when you were doing your doctoral dissertation, I think the really interesting term that you came up with was this idea how we're embedded in our psychological processes, so that there is no enduring permanent sense of I, so that we're mentally embedded, we're emotionally embedded, we're physically and practically embedded in various processes. And when you were writing your dissertation, you used to come to Ottawa and bring the latest work product that you had, and you were sort of developing this, and I kept reading it over and over again. There'd be a few more pages each time, and it was growing, and I must have read it 20 times over all these visits. And I remember I would always be reading it, and you would be talking about this idea of being mentally embedded, and you'd say, like, when a person is perceiving something, are they consciously aware of themselves here perceiving it? No, they're mentally embedded within the object perception process. And the next sentence that you have is, just as you, the reader, while you have been reading these pages, are not likely to have been self-consciously aware of yourself as perceiving or reading the pages. Now, every time I read that, I would realize that I had been mentally embedded in the process of reading your manuscript. I mean, I knew it was coming, and I wrote this in my book about you, and even when I reread it, I still can't remember it. To me, like, seriously, that was like as I say, you can do 15,000 experiments murdering rats. You're never going to be able to prove anything more important to me than that, what that tells me about the nature of our normal waking consciousness. This is an incredibly important thing. And if people really understood, like at one point, Uspensky said to Gurdjieff something like, that he was dissatisfied because he couldn't remember himself. And Gurdjieff said, wait a minute, what else do you want? He said, you understand that you don't remember yourself. You have to realize how important that is. Most people don't realize it. And if you told them that, they'd think you're an utter fool for trying to tell them that. This is a hugely important realization, to understand that you don't remember yourself. And as I say, there's just nothing in psychology that even, in my estimation, even comes close to the importance of this idea of self-remembering, and that we don't normally do this. It's the key to everything. It's the missing link. Okay? It's a concept, but it's also a method and a practice and a discipline, which is the key to making that transition from what we are to what we can become.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, it's been amazing. I can't imagine having lived life without it. Like, in a way, self-remembering in my life, like, I wouldn't have given up learning of that practice or method. I wouldn't give it up. Like, $1 million, I wouldn't give up. Because in a way, it transformed life in an inner way, like enabling me to kind of become more and more free of negative emotions and conditioning by things and being controlled by external stimuli and learning to be awake to the fullness of the moment more and more through my life. So over the time, the practice of self-remembering has profoundly valuable inner effects, and you experience the effect of it on yourself over time. It's an amazing process. I just found this great quote from Patterson, which is a very succinct kind of quotation of Gurdjieff, where he tries to explain what self-remembering is. And he says, "I am, always, I am, never forget. Little by little, your eye shall make a contact with your essence. It is necessary to repeat it many times." And that's like, in a way, what self-remembering is. It's like you start going about your life, and every now and then you try to remember, oh yeah, I am. And you try to be aware in a state of wakefulness wherever you are, whatever you're doing. And you try to enhance that moment of being wakefulness, and it's like the reality of life begins to be revealed to you. Because normally everybody goes around in such a cloud of thoughts and feelings and so on that completely take them over, and they're all the time lost in it. Whereas you begin to self-remember and you start increasing your wakefulness, and as you do it, it goes, everything in the system's tied into other things. It's like self-remembering goes with struggle against negative emotions, because the more you self-remember, you begin to be aware of your own negative emotions when they come up, and you work with your breath and you try to release them and maintain your wakefulness. So it's like, as you self-remember, more and more of these things that you are attached to or identified with, they drop away, and it leaves you in that state of heightened wakefulness, and that can be cultivated. It's like what you were saying earlier, consciousness can vary in states of consciousness, but also in degrees. Like, we can be more or less self-remembering or more or less awake. It's not just an either or. It's, you know, we need to enhance the presence of consciousness in our life. So we set ourselves the intention to self-remember and then try to remember that as we go about our life, having moments of waking up and remembering how long it was since we forgot ourselves. I mean, I've gone through periods of life where you forget yourself for months. You completely forget for months or even years of self-remembering. And then you come back to it. But over time, it builds something in you, something in that's deeper in your sense of I.
I think one of the things that you touched on earlier that's so important about it, and as you study it and practice it, you begin to understand the importance of the idea that identification is the opposite of self-remembering, and you can't remember yourself if you're identified. And in a sense, really, the practice of self-remembering really brings out the importance of identification and how we're always identified and how everything in life leads us and it conditions us and reinforces our identifications with everything. And that's what you want to do, is you want to disidentify and how, in a way, how that's the key to liberation and to self-mastery, is to be disidentified from things and to withdraw from things emotionally, in the sense of trying to remember your I, trying to have the I experience and not be identified, not be invested and emotionally embedded in things. It's like in a sense, like identification is the emotional medium in which we exist. It's like, you know, it's like the old line about what does a fish, Einstein's line about what does a fish know about the water in which it swims. You know, that's why our emotional identification state. And the more you understand identification and can free yourself from it, the more you can remember yourself, the more you transform the meaning of life. Like, you can't change the facts of life, you can't change the events of life, but you can change the meaning of life. And I think that's what's the light of the Gurdjieff system for me is, and of esoteric teachings, is that they don't change life, but they change the meaning of life in such extraordinary and undeniable ways that you realize that you're in contact, when you can remember to remember, you're in contact with something really incredibly powerful and deep and mysterious and something which is from above this world. Like, that's where I have faith. I believe that esoteric teachings are these vehicles for us to experience the truths and influences from higher levels of reality. I believe that. I have faith in that, in the sense that I can't prove it or touch it or, you know, explain it totally clearly, but my experience that makes sense with my experience of these things, and so I have faith in that sense, that I believe in these hidden realities and these higher realities and these more objective realities.
Okay, I noticed, Jim, we're coming down to just a few minutes here. We've got through five or six of our definitions, and we'll finish that off next week. Just to encourage readers or listeners, I have a website at zeropoint.ca, and if you go to that website and look at the table of contents for my book, Psychological Illusions, you can read a chapter there on self-remembering. And it's very valuable and practical notes for people. And we'll come back to this next time. I try to encourage listeners, try to remember yourself over the next week. When I used to teach self-remembering to a class of university students, I'd have a class and I'd talk about an hour or two to try to explain it, get everybody to try to do it. And a week later, we'd come back and I said, how many people would self-remember? And usually it was like about a third or half of the class remembered to do it. And everybody else completely forgot, or else they remembered to do it the morning before the class. Yeah, because they had the class coming back, and then their process of associative thinking reminded them that they were supposed to self-remember, and then they probably didn't self-remember. They probably just spent some time thinking about themselves and thinking that their thinking about themselves was self-remembering, but it's not. Self-remembering isn't thinking about yourself. It's not analyzing yourself. It's being present. It's being awake. It's trying to experience I am in the fullness of your I. And if we do this over time, it begins to help develop something in us. And when I used to teach it at York University, students had to keep a journal of self-study, because I said, if you want to study psychology, you have to study yourself. And it was amazing how much students loved learning this practice of self-remembering. Because they were going about their life, and at all different times, a guy riding on a bus, and it's like all of a sudden he remembered himself, and he was just aware of moving along in the bus and aware of everyone around him. It was like all these people having these little moments of awakening in situations where they normally would have been completely absorbed by what was happening, but all of a sudden they were having these moments where they came back to breathing and sensing themselves and being more fully present. And it, in a way, it's a thrilling and exciting thing, and it leads to all kinds of insights into your own nature and dynamics. Okay, so thanks, Jim.
Yep, thanks, Chris. Try to remember
we'll be back in 2 weeks. We'll pick up on with some of the fourth way material, finish off these definitions. Thank you, BBS Radio. Any last comments, or Jim?
Yeah, we used to use a reminder. Try to remember yourself when you're traveling somewhere. To narrow it down as a reminder. Try to remember yourself when you're in transition from one place to another.
It was so useful for me. I think I learned that about, I got in the habit, in a way, of remembering to remember myself when I walked into work in the morning, when I worked in the prisons and when I worked at the university. That was a time when I would remember myself and try to clear my mind and be present as I go into university. But you're traveling, there's lots of different ways of approaching it. Okay, thank you all. Thanks, BBS Radio. We'll be back in 2 weeks. Please visit my website. I have 2 books on Gurdjieff. They're excellent books, both available through Amazon. Thank you all. Goodbye.